The writer is going to be Roger Galanas, director for Fogarty International Center. We're going to be talking about the importance of education in global health. Ya vimos, ya escuchamos sobre la diplomacia, ya hablamos de los determinantes sociales.
And development. We've heard about the history of global health. Today we're going to, and in this session, we're going to speak specifically about education and new models of multidisciplinary education. I'm Roger Glass. I'm the director of the Fogarty International Center, and we've had a history of 40 years of working on research and training in global health with a long history. And I'm delighted that we have here Pierce Gardner and Sten Vermund, who have worked with our programs of fellows and scholars and are very knowledgeable if you have questions about it. So we're delighted to see this panel of distinguished speakers and academics to tell us how we can educate the next generation of global health professionals. Our lineup includes Dr. Hiram Arroyo from the University of Puerto Rico, an educator by training, who's been outstanding in as a professor of health promotion, health education. He's the director of the WHO Coordinating Center for Training and Research in Health Promotion, and he's been involved in lots of inter-American activities. In the United States, where Hispanics will soon become a majority population by 2050, it's wonderful to have someone from Puerto Rico who can help us bridge the gap between North America and South America. So we're delighted to have you here. Pierre Boukens is from the Tulane University. He's the dean of the School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine at Tulane, a professor of epidemiology, an academic, and OBGYN who's had a long history. He has a father who's Dutch, a mother who's French, a wife who's Mexican, and he's working in the United States. How more global can you be? King Holmes has had a lifelong history in infectious diseases and has evolved over the past decade to be the Bill Foege Chair of Global Health at the University of Washington. He's the head of the infectious disease section at Harborview Medical Center. He's the principal investigator on an international training and research center on HIV. And he's had more than 40 years work throughout the world on STIs, but now more recently on global health in Seattle. And you know, Seattle is where a lot of the money in global health comes from. So he's in a wonderful position to tell us about this. And finally, Ted Schrecker from the University of Ottawa. He's a political scientist. He's an agitator. Political scientist by training, agitator by bent, I guess. And so we have an educator, an agitator, an international globalist by birth, and an STI global health person, all to speak with you in this session. Without further ado, we'll have 15-minute presentations, about 12-minute presentations, a few minutes for questions after each, and then a full discussion of 30 minutes at the end of the session. So let me invite Dr. Arroyo to begin the session.
Muy buenos días a todos y a todas. Muchísimas gracias por la invitación que nos cursan los organizadores y las autoridades del Instituto Nacional de Salud Pública de Cuernavaca. Un gusto enorme estar acá y un saludo a nombre de Puerto Rico. Yo quisiera aprovechar esta oportunidad de exposición para plantear como asunto primario, ¿no?, la importancia de la promoción de la salud
y la topic, the importance of health promotion and the proposal for health promotion as an alternative in order to train human resources, interdisciplinary human resources, to benefit and to strengthen the actions of global health. And if we talk about health promotion, we haven't talked about health promotion because health determinants are one of the arms, ideological and operational arms of health promotion. The presentation that I will make has to necessarily come together with names of organizations we've been defending in the last 20 years. We have defended the need to train human resources and to train people in every area, not only health promotion, not only in the Inter-American region, but also globally. And the organizations which are, for example, the Pan-American Health Organization and other centers that belong to the PAHO. These are some of the non-government entities, the Health Promotion Unit and Health Education Unit. And obviously, we are also talking about the networks of professionals and academic networks, which are still active in our Latin American region, talking about training and education of human resources. And this is the University Inter-American Consortium. The topic of training human resources and education human resources interdisciplinary. And let's talk about public health. And we should always relate this topic to the disciplines of public health, to the tradition, to the very important tradition we have of education for health. And in recent years, obviously, all this development for health promotion, we are celebrating 24 years of this strategy implementation using the Ottawa chart for health promotion. So the reference frame we are defending is a frame of health promotion as a proposal, as a paradigm, as an intervention strategy, as a new public health from the perspective of some countries and some institutions. And you know, it is addressed, or it is going to be a political process and a strategic process, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary approach as an educational proposal for the development of professionals, not only in the field of health, but also in every field of the social sciences and some other decision areas. In other words, first we have the need to strengthen these interdisciplinary actions. And there's one first problem. The institutional history in our region tells us that the needs of education of human resources and training human resources in recent years is focused in public schools only, and public health schools, and sometimes the structure of these public health schools do not allow for progress, do not allow us to progress, do not allow us to have resources, which are... So there is a structural problem here, because this is a problem we see in public health schools, and this is also a problem in education, and there's no way to make progress to promote health. These strategic lines to promote health, this has been relatively stable as of 1986 to the present time. These are the different working lines, and there is a redimension of all this, and there are new faces and there are new voices in view of the global policies, including the health social determinants. And we've been in this process. We are implementing actions to promote health. We make some progress, but we also face problems in the operational aspect of the implementation. We have had an institutional history in terms of health promotion. You have the landmarks of health promotion, as you know, and the most recent one, the conference Health in Nairobi by the World Health Organization. It was held 6 months ago in Nairobi, and there we talk about the responsibilities to do health promotion, and we need to strengthen the leadership and whatever is related to the development of labor force. There is a debate that we've seen in recent times, which is a debate to determine whether or not health promotion specialists are required or not, if universities have to train specialists in health promotion, or if the alternative proposal should be the strengthening of actions to train transversally human resources in every subject of the health sciences and related areas. In other words, to have a persisting debate. For example, it is present in our Latin American region. We are going to see how we have had different responses to this debate on training programs for human resources. I will quickly review this because we are very short of time, so that we have more time for questions. These are all the different challenges, and these are the different strategies and actions. In the case of the Pan American Health Organization here, and this one is going to promote health from a transversal perspective. At this moment, there are many projects, virtual projects for the staff of the organization. These are proposals for health staff in the operational stages in the different countries, and there is an inventory of approaches which are presented transversally in order to insist on this training of our professionals. In the last decade, we've seen in our region, as well as globally, we've seen different meetings where we have focused on the need to strengthen the education of our health specialists. There is also a need to reorient university actions because we want proposals to talk about the specialization field, as we said a while ago. And we have lots of background information. In our Latin American context, for example, I would like to quickly share with you the following. The review that we made of the different training professional specialized educational programs on health promotion, the experience of these programs. There are four main approaches. There are four main approaches. Education for health, and you know that in the case of Latin American context, as of the 40s, specialized programs were started in Puerto Rico, São Paulo, Cuba, in Chile. There were different programs. There are programs, there are initiatives in this area. There is a second current, which is the one that we call the specialization in health promotion. This comes from 1990. It is becoming stronger, and this one third mode that was established in 1995, and this is academic and specialization programs that will combine whatever is related to education for health, the present, the education for health of the present. Here we have individual health behaviors. We also include the health promotion, and of course we also include determinants. And we do this success, we also include other training models. In other countries, we have a diversity of modes, modalities, and approaches. At the level of master, diverse master programs, and there are other alternatives, there are other possibilities to train human resources. There are mixed programs. This is another methodology. And these are some of the examples that we will not describe. I will not describe the conceptual frame of each one of them, but this is just for you to have an overview of what is the accelerated movement that our region sees in terms of health promotion and specialization. And there are some countries where we see the following evidence. As long as we have specialized human resources, we're going to be able to be more efficient in the promotion and implementation of public policies in this case in order to do health promotion. At the global level, you know, there has been a trend in higher education institutions as well as in other educational centers to reorient all these training actions using the competence models, skill models. This is a different name. And we have also seen in the Latin American region, and we've seen this globally as well. And you can see that nowadays we have very specific examples, like in the global sphere, for example. We are developing at this very moment projects, specific human resource education projects in health promotion, for health promotion. Can we see each one of these projects, the European perspective, Australian perspective, Latin American perspective? We also have the North American perspective, and you can see the attempt and effort made by the academic and by the professional sectors to identify the different areas and guidelines in order to train professionals. This material I can be shared with you, of course. It would be important to tell you we will have no time to see this, but it would be important to see the different articulation elements between one project and other projects. Whenever we talk about global health, we need to recognize there is a relative consensus and articulation conceptually and methodologically on the things which are to be included in professional education and training programs for health promotion, and you can see that the articulation elements are very present and are very clear. There are other projects. This by the PAHO, which is an additional attempt to set competencies and the guidelines, and we have been able to achieve so for health promotion. Today we are in the second round of assessments or evaluations of each one of these guidelines in order to properly implement the competence-based approach. At the level of the, or talking about the global proposal, there is a very specific recommendation. Training of human resources should have minimum content. This is something approved by international entities and by the experts of the academic sectors. It is summarized in these guidelines. Here we are talking about 12 working guides, and many of them include the strategic, basic, and ideological guidelines to do health promotion, the models and the contextual portion. We also have the effectiveness evidence. We submit evidence and the products of health promotion, intersectorial work, point number 4, and the approach of health social determinants, etc. We don't have more time. And what I would like to tell you is that at this moment, the International Union for Health Promotion and Health Education has an additional project to define professional competencies, which is the Galloway Consensus Proposal, which is gathering the criteria of global experts in order to try to unify training criteria using the reference frame of health promotion, health social determinants, and then to have a proposal based on 8 general principles, and I will not share with you because we obviously have no time for that. Thank you very much. I have one more question for Professor Arroyo. Are there questions for Professor Arroyo? La importancia de la investigación, el Dr. Arroyo, en capacitación. ¿Puede hacer un comentario breve? La importancia of research in global health training. Of course, we value the academic centers that have experience in terms of health promotion, and here as part of the curricula we can see the different areas of content of knowledge. There is a very important component of general research, but we have other specific proposals, specific courses on the area of global health. In other words, it is a content that is present and many of the university institutions will work with practical experiences and they can exchange international experiences. Are there more questions?
Reason why Venezuela is not in your health promotion programs?
Sí, en el caso de Venezuela.
Yes, Venezuela is not included because there is one specific reason. In the network of the Inter-American Consortium for Health Promotion, we do not have at this very moment a program specialized in health promotion. There are other programs, general public health. They somehow focused on health promotion, but there are no complete programs in Venezuela. There are no undergraduate or graduate programs to do health promotion. The reference frame was more on specialization programs. Muy bien, muchas gracias, Dr. Arroyo, muchas gracias. Luego vamos a tener a Pierre. Pierre, él es el decano de la escuela.
Tulane, and here we are at the School of Public Health in Mexico. He's going to speak to us about, is global health public health? Pierre.
Gracias, Roger, por la introducción.
Thanks for the introduction. With all my family, I will speak no language correctly, so I will speak in English, but I will be able to answer in Spanish, and I will be pleased to be with you again. La salud global es la salud pública, entonces no estoy seguro.
I want to have this discussion with you. A good point from what I learned yesterday is that we all use and share the same definition, GHAG, the public health community. We all believe, know that global health, it's not international health. It's really tackling and addressing health issues we have in common together. It's about health issues of major significance in both industrialized and developing countries. And even these labels, you know, do not mean much nowadays. We should say low, middle, and high-income countries. And even that, Roger is always teasing me that I'm in Louisiana, and most of my grants are in collaboration with Argentina. And, you know, if you compare, you know, what's happening in Buenos Aires and New Orleans, often Buenos Aires is much more developed than New Orleans. So it's all about the global world and trying to find solutions together. It's really not about domestic versus international. It's about everything we have in common. So the good point, I think, is that we share that view and that vision. The Institute here shares that vision. GHEC shares that vision. And the Schools of Public Health also share that vision. So that's a good foundation. Now, we have a history to deal with. And in the U.S., more than anywhere else in the world, I think, there is a strong division between public health and medicine with completely different schools, different deans, which is good, so I have a job. Of course, a lot of interactions and collaborations, but yet, for about a century now, a division, sometimes a tension between public health, which is very population-oriented, and deal with health except with individual patient care, and medical schools, which are more oriented toward individual patient care. Our accreditation system, CEF, the Council of Education for Public Health, which is accrediting this institute and this school, which is a CEF accredited school, is absolutely keen to verify in a very detailed way that we are completely independent from School of Medicine. It's absolutely needed for accreditation. So that's, you know, that's the history and that's where we are. So, of course, from a public health perspective, because we work a lot around the world, we feel that, you know, global health is mostly public health. So you can see this as being, you know, a very self-serving approach, and perhaps it is. There was a debate in The Lancet during the last few weeks about this, and it was a debate among friends, you know. There was a paper suggesting that public health, international health, and global health should be really differentiated, and that public health is more about domestic programs. And then we wrote this response, but also this general viewpoint, saying, well, if you're really globalizing, if you really believe that you shouldn't have a special program about international health, then if you globalize epidemiology, if you globalize health systems management, you globalize health behaviors, then at the end, you know, what we do in schools of public health is not very different from what you would do in a school of global health. So that's the reason of this kind of counterpoint, saying global health is public health, you know, signed by many deans of schools of public health around the U.S. It was a U.S. paper, not a very global paper, by the way. So, you know, is it about public health? Is it about medicine? It's probably about both. And that's why I like this meeting. Well, you have the GHEC meeting in a CEF-accredited School of Public Health. It's about both, and it's going beyond that, because it's clearly more multidisciplinary than just public health and medicine. It's really going beyond that, and I think that, you know, it's really an honor here to be here with Roger Glass, because Fogarty International Center has been pushing us, I think, toward the right direction, which is to work together in a very multidisciplinary fashion. This is an NIH press release, Roger, one among many, but this one is when you announce the last round of funding for the framework program, which is including funding for the framework in this school, and Nelly Salgado, the PI, is here with us today and one of the organizers of this meeting. And the fact that the framework programs, which really try to globalize health research, have PIs not only in the U.S., but also in China, in Peru, and in Mexico, is really the right way to go. So I think Fogarty is helping us to go beyond our usual divides, which is great. That being said, let me go back to schools of public health, because, you know, global health is public health, right? So let me change hats a little bit. I'm the chair of the Global Health Committee of the Association of Schools of Public Health. And ASPH has a lot of member schools, around 50 now, including this school. And to be a member, you need to be a CEF-accredited school of public health. That number is growing very fast, very quickly. So I think that very soon there will be a school of public health everywhere where there is a school of medicine. And there are places where there is a school of public health and no school of medicine. So I don't see this as being competition. I see this as being a wonderful opportunity for collaboration and working together and try to go beyond this divide. You know? But going beyond this divide doesn't mean that you have to borrow identities, you know? Globalization doesn't mean you have to borrow local cultures. And globalization in academia doesn't mean you have to borrow all this diversity we have in approaches. And so that will mean negotiations, a lot of health diplomacy, also in academia. Now, one of the things we're doing at the Global Health Committee, where we wrote this paper in The Lancet, but we also now developing competencies for global health training. And the important point, of course, is that we will develop competencies for voluntary use by academic institutions. which, I mean, every dean of a school of public health translates that immediately by thinking this will be compulsory, and if you don't follow these competencies, you will have problems with your CEF accreditation. And actually, it will not be compulsory, but because you need to follow competencies to be accredited, if there is a set of competencies proposed by ESPH, it will, I think, have some importance within the school, and we hope that it will go way beyond that. So we are starting by developing competencies for the ones being in specialized programs with a global health stone, but the objective down the road, and not long from now, will be really to have competencies which every student in Masters of Public Health will need to have. We really want to globalize the curriculum, and we want to get rid of this division between domestic and international health. So this is a profound change for us. And the approach is that we identified seven domains. And we didn't do this ourselves. We have a very large conference in Minneapolis with a mix of colleagues from academia and from the field, from the U.S. and from abroad, and they identify the areas in which they believe we have to develop the competencies. And now we are embarking in three rounds of a Delphi process for each domain. We have two chairs for each domain. Laura Magaña is one of the chairs for one of the domains we're going to be working on, and each group has 10 members. So you have 70 people there. And then the last round of Delphi will be really open to the community. So we are expecting that several hundred people will participate in this process. We have used this process before to develop competencies for many other fields in public health. So it's a kind of a routine protocol we're following. And we have been very successful in doing this and in having a very large group of stakeholders being part of the process. So they really bind to the process. And that makes the competencies very important at the end. So we hope to complete this in April 2011. And here are the domains. And they might be surprising to you because they are very broad. Because this is not about malaria or about maternal mortality, because we are globalizing. It's about what you have to add to this globalized curriculum in terms of capacity building, in terms of health equity, in terms of ethical reasoning, collaboration, partnering. So all these domains will be populated with competencies to really try to globalize the curriculum. So we try to have a global approach. We try to do this within the schools of public health, but also with everybody else. And I'm looking forward to the session this afternoon about competencies, because competencies are developed by GHEC. A colleague from Cuba is presenting. The institute here is also developing competencies. And by working together, I think we can really have this global approach with a really a share of expertise and two ways win-win collaborations. Merci beaucoup.
Pierre, thank you. Let's open this for questions. We have, see a hand here, a hand here. Starts then.
Sten Vermont from Vanderbilt University. Pierre, that was terrific. I did think those were very broad competency domains. Just what you predicted many of us would think is exactly what we thought. How are you going to avoid the risk in an interdisciplinary program of someone coming out with a master's degree in global health and they can't answer the question, I am a blank. I am an epidemiologist. I am an MCH expert. I am a monitoring evaluation expert. I am a health economist. I am a water and sanitation expert. In other words, interdisciplinary training in global health could be too broad.
Oh, thank you, Stan. I'm sorry if I think I didn't explain exactly what I was intending to explain. The very first wave, it's for global health programs, because we had to start somewhere. But we hope that 2 years down the road, those competencies will be used to globalize the entire curriculum. So the concept is that you're going to keep graduating with a Master of Public Health in Epidemiology, but it will be from a global program. So everybody will keep specializing in the discipline biostatistics, epi environmental health, but will be global environmental health, global community health sciences. Instead of having a set of students graduating from international global health and everybody else not being global. So that's the intention.
I am Leonel Valdivia from University of Chile School of Public Health.
From...
You are a dean of the School of Public Health. My dean is right here, and I work with him on global health issues. And so I just wanted to bring it into the local level. What does it take for a School of Public Health like ours or like yours to implement this? Are there any practical steps or things that have to be done? Because we like this approach very much. We are new to global health, but we do want this globalized perspective on public health. And we are the School of Public Health, and it seems that throughout the world, the leaders in global health are public health people, like it is the case with us in Chile. But what would it take for our local institution, like yours, like ours, to implement this?
Well, it would be up to your dean to say what you're going to do in Chile, but certainly in the U.S. the approach is first to globalize the way you teach the core courses, to make sure that you have a mix of examples and approaches coming from all around the world, and then so that's the first step. And I think a pioneer in this area has been the University of North Carolina School of Global Public Health now, because they have decided not to have a separate program, but to globalize each of the core courses. And then the following approach is, you know, to emphasize the new competencies we are developing. That might need some specialized courses for everybody to have a chance. It might not be, you know, formal courses. There might be seminars, but to approach that. But the globalization of the core courses, I think, is the first approach. Having examples from China, Mexico, Africa, Belgium, you know, mm-hmm. all mixed. We don't do this very often in the U.S. You might, I don't know.
Next question. We'll have two quick questions.
Yeah, wonderful dean. I think your team's at the right direction. We have a global
Oh, no, I mean, it's a good point. We absolutely... Yeah, I think the question was, is this a global process? I mean, are you involving people, you know, from the South in this process of developing competencies? And we try. So we had, you know, several colleagues coming from the stakeholder conference, and we're going to open the process, especially the online process, will be as global and worldwide as possible. Because you're right, we have to globalize global health, right?
Last question.
I'm Linda Wilson. I'm from the University of Alabama in Birmingham School of Nursing, and I'd just like to put a plug to add into your mixture, medicine, public health, nursing, engineering, you know, all of the disciplines, and to share that what I'll be presenting tomorrow is an initiative building on the GHEC competencies. We've done a survey to identify nursing educators' perceptions of what should be the global competencies for nurses in the Americas. So we had it in Spanish, Portuguese, and English. Because I think this idea of globalizing the curricula of all the health professions is really an important way to move forward. Thanks.
I agree.
Great. Well, that's a nice way to end this session. Thank you very much. Pierre. And we'll continue now with King Holmes. King is going to speak with us about the... University of Washington's interdisciplinary global health education curriculum development. And I guess the question to ask King as he's coming to the podium is that I've had lots of problems having different disciplines work together. Can it really happen, King?
All right. That's a great question, Roger. I'll try to address it.
You're a king for that reason, Kay.
I wanted to say that the last GHEC meeting was held at the University of Washington, Seattle, in collaboration with our Western Regional Conference. And it was, I thought, a big success, but I think this meeting is an even bigger success. I want to thank the INSP and GHEC for inviting me to come here, and also for the really outstanding science, social programs, the networking that's occurring here, which make this meeting a very valuable meeting, I think, for all of us. So what is the value of universities in global health, the added value, and of academia in general? And it's, first of all, in research to try to solve problems, some of the gaps in knowledge that are critical to improving global health. And secondly, it's workforce capacity development for global health. And both the research and the workforce capacity development rest critically on education, training, and mentoring. So what we're talking about in this session really pertains to both. And Pierre, my Department of Global Health is in two schools. I get to report to two deans. One is the Dean of Medicine and one is the Dean of Public Health. And that has its pluses and its minuses. But it makes me think of this field as interdisciplinary, and hence responding to this challenge of talking about interdisciplinary education is good. So next slide. I guess we don't have a pointer here, do we, or can I use that one? So this is our first entering class of our new Department of Global Health, which came in the fall of 2007. And this is the master's degree, the program, the group that are specifically just in the master's degree. And I want to thank, in going along, Steve Gloyd, who is associate chair of our department and helped with this presentation. And let's see, maybe I'll just ask for the next slide. Thanks. So I'll tell you a few things about our curriculum and education program. We initially were charged with serving not only the schools of medicine and public health, but all of the health sciences. And also we were told to help enable all of the other schools, the other 11 schools, we have 17 schools, to be able to bring their disciplines to global health. And so we formed a curriculum advisory committee that meets six times a year, and we have representatives from all 17 schools and colleges. There are about 50 members of the committee. And they really help us envision interdisciplinary programs. And we have continued to develop new programs, define competencies and courses, and we have working groups in several areas. And we've been able to establish linkages with other educational programs at the university. There we go. A quick summary now of our core programs in global health in the graduate school are the master's program. And we have a general track, 39 students, a leadership policy and management postgraduate course, a number of them. We have a health metrics program with 8 in the master's track for health metrics. We have 16 who are in the Peace Corps master's program and 13 in concurrent degree master's programs with other schools, and I'll say a bit about that. We have a basic science and global health program, a predoctoral program called pathobiology with 33 students. And then we have two fellowships right now. We just were funded by NIH for another. But the two existing ones are a post-baccalaureate program in the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation and a postgraduate program. These are essentially postdoctoral fellowships. And we also have 202 students who are in graduate certificate programs, which require at least 15 credits in global health. And there is the global health certificate that can be taken by people in any number of schools, 43 in that. We have an AIDS and STD graduate certificate program, which is headed by our department. And then a physician global health pathway, which has rapidly emerged to be the most common track in the School of Medicine for medical students. And then we also, interestingly, and I've encouraged this, not discouraged it, seen global health programs emerge with global health certification on the degrees awarded in the schools of international affairs, public affairs, law, anthropology, geography, and other schools are beginning to contemplate that. Our curriculum currently involves 59 courses that are in Department of Global Health and the PhD predoctoral program. And these include 29 that are cross-listed with other departments, interdisciplinary courses by definition. And we have plans for adding predoctoral programs in metrics and evaluation and implementation science. This would be one program with which about 70% overlap in courses. And we have several distance learning courses that have emerged that range from our 30% of the country region for the medical school to multi-country lectures I'll say more about. We have new signature programs that are developing that are interesting. We have new graduate programs, a leadership management and policy MPH, which is done in conjunction with the Master's in Health Administration program of the Department of Health Services, the School of Public Affairs, and the Foster School of Business. And this has been approved but not yet implemented as a master's track. And we have a health metrics and evaluation master's program, which I mentioned earlier, that's approved. And now we are planning a global health PhD separate from our basic science program with two components, health metrics and evaluation and implementation science. We estimate we're at least a couple years away from that just because of the bureaucratic processes, but have most of the courses in place. And we are developing an undergraduate minor we hope to begin next year with huge amounts of students. One department, anthropology, added a global health component to its degree program, and the number of undergraduates enrolled increased in 1 year from 300 to 600, which indicates to you and me what the level of interest is. I mentioned the distance learning with multiple countries and sites. And we have a new interdisciplinary course in global environmental health that's in the planning stage. And we have two new implementation science courses, one with PATH and one with Health Alliance International, involving electrical engineering in the business school. I'm sorry, industrial engineering in the business school. We have six different global health leadership and management courses that are externally funded, not all of which are degree programs at our school yet. We have courses that are offered now annually at partner institutions that include those universities in Peru, Kenya, Namibia, Uganda, Cote d'Ivoire, Mozambique, India, China, and Cambodia. And we have engaged our local faculty from a number of universities that have joined our department as affiliate members, from PATH, Seattle Biomed, Washington State University, the Fred Hutch Cancer Center, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And then we are developing self-sustaining summer institutes. We've tried to look at the workforce snapshot. This is a one-day look, looking at what's online. And we looked at these three websites. And you can just get a picture that the jobs being advertised were mostly NGO jobs from all of these. There are a smattering of others. And looking at where the jobs are available, it's mostly sub-Saharan Africa. It's interesting that the Global Health Council listed more in the U.S. and Canada. The other category presumably includes Latin America, but there's not much said about that. This is the way typically schools are defining where the jobs are. I think this is totally misleading. I think as we go around to all of our academic schools, they all want to have people trained in global health. The private sector wants people trained in global health. I think the job market is much different from what you get from this kind of a survey, and it's going to change in the future. The estimated shortage you've heard earlier of all health workers is 4.3 million. How many of these should be physicians, midwives, nurses, and others remains to be discussed. I'm going to skip this because the time allowed has been reduced. And we had a curriculum retreat with 45 of our attendees, mostly faculty. And the six highlights recommended, and this was last fall, were to nurture and strengthen interdisciplinary partnerships. 21 voted for that. We weren't pushing it, but this lets you see what they're looking for. To offer training and implementation science skills, equally popular. To enhance our leadership curriculum, 19 of the group. Strengthen institutional academic partnerships, both international and locally. Utilize the Global Health Justice Framework and establish a unifying Global Health Foundation course, which is unique. We hadn't done that yet and are doing it. We have a very nice distinguished external advisory committee who met in December, and their key recommendations were to think about public health science and define disparities and causes of disparities. That's only the first step. They and our students say we need to teach them how to correct these disparities. We need to have tangible goals to reduce disparities using an MDG-oriented focus and teach problem solving, use case studies, simulations, learn how to navigate systems. The advisors felt that it's easy to find technical experts. What they need to hire is problem solvers. I'll skip that and just say that this is our first graduating class, that not all of them, but they were quite happy to be graduating and happy with the curriculum as it's developing. But I think the strongest thing they emphasized in their feedback, we met with them all when they'd gotten their degrees to say, now tell us what you really think. And they said, enough about teaching us what the problems are and the socio-cultural determinants of bad health. Tell us what to do about it. And that's what we're currently working on. Thank you very much.
King, that was a very, very engaging discussion, and you've really gotten all of the University of Washington engaged. We wish we could all do that. And let's open it up for questions.
Thank you very much. Terrific talk. My name is Steve Rumsey. I'm actually with Bunge Alimentos, which is a food and agriculture company. And my question relates to behavioral modification as a competency in this area of public health, and how much emphasis is put on this in the curriculum. And thinking about, as you think about the areas of careers where this competency is principally located, you could think about marketing in industry or politics, and how does your curriculum tap into or potentially link into that competency as a way of actually doing what you said in one of your slides, effecting change on a large scale?
Well, the key slide I didn't show had to do with some of this. When I took this job, I was advised by Gina Dalabetta, who was working on the Avahan project in India at the time, not to hire anybody from medicine or public health, to only hire people from the business world who had experience in marketing and how to change behaviors. We haven't followed that course, but we are attempting to collaborate with others who are active in that area. And in terms of, you know, the argument for why we need an interdisciplinary curriculum, if you think about the underlying factors that are responsible, which we heard a lot about yesterday, that requires socio-political sciences, law, and others. And we are quite engaged with them in trying to train people to be active in communication and in changes in behavior, although that's one of the toughest things, as you know, that without corresponding structural policy changes is tough. Big successes in tobacco control clearly have been multi-component interventions in Hong Kong, for example, and Mexico. Then you come to the intermediate causes, which include things like poverty, access to education, job conditions, and so on. And here you need to add the political sciences and education. And then you get to the proximate causes, which are things like malnutrition, water, sanitation, where you're beginning to talk about engineering, urban design, public health, and the built environment. And then you come to the diseases per se, and that's when you're really talking about public health and medicine and nursing and pharmacy and dentistry and so on. So I think, you know, it's great that this meeting has been held at the Institut National de Salud Pública, and it's appropriately really brought public health to the fore. I think that public health is clearly as currently configured, is one of the most important aspects of global health. And along with medicine, nursing, pharmacy, social work, dentistry, law, business, urban planning, education, engineering, and basic sciences, all of which are quite important and why we need interdisciplinary education for our students.
Last question, Tom Novotny.
The broad range of involvement of other departments and schools is really impressive. And I wondered whether at the level of the chancellor or the president or just from the department, how much incentive was required to get this involvement, or was it pretty much because of the just broad and widespread interest in global health that's been growing in general?
Mainly the latter, although clearly also the former. I mean, we went around and met with every dean, and they were they had all their global health people to meet with us when we were getting started, very interested in participating. We were told by Chris Murray from Harvard at the beginning that you couldn't get people to work in a cross-disciplinary or interdisciplinary way. That hasn't proven to be the case at all in our experience. I mean, there are issues you have to deal with academically, like, you know, who gets the activity-based budgeting allocation and things like that, but that's solvable.
Thank you very much, King. That was wonderful, and we'll move on. The last presentation of this session is Ted Schrecker. He's going to talk to us and speak with us about the third wave in global health research, implications for education. And since I mentioned in my introduction that he was an agitator and he was going to rough us all up, I would say, what does a political scientist have to tell us about global health? And what does the perspective of the WHO Commission on Social Determinants of Health mean for global health education? Ted, advise us. Educate us.
I will try. I'd like to thank Dr. Salgado for the invitation to be part of this program. I'm honored to be here, and I now have the task, after a day and a half of impressive presentations, of saying something useful that has not been said before while standing between a few hundred people and their lunch. Nellie, why was I thanking you again? You want to remind me? This presentation is in two parts. The first part, based on an exercise that was completed in the latter part of last year, after the release of the WHO Commission report, WHO informally asked a group of us who'd been active in the work of the Commission, led by Piroshka Ostlund from Sweden, to update an earlier document on research priorities in health equity. And we ended up basically rewriting the document, which you see here, in the process identifying what we call three waves in global health research. The first wave involves biomedical disciplines and the life sciences, seeking to develop scientific understandings that lead to clinical responses, usually delivered in clinical settings by health professionals. The second wave involves a focus on health systems, public health interventions, for example, with respect to non-communicable diseases. Both these waves are now well-established and indispensable. And we argued the need as well for a third wave of health research, much less well-developed, focusing on social determinants of health as affected by social and economic policies and upstream political choices. Upstream is a word that Sir Michael Marmot has actually used. The third wave presents a whole range of challenges for developing research strategies and methodologies, starting with going beyond the behavioral and other individual determinants of illness, the lifestyle factors that health promotion people like to talk about, notably to examine the intersections among different social hierarchies and their cumulative impacts on health disparities. And I mention cumulative impacts because there's quite good evidence that, in fact, the stresses associated with various kinds of social inequality accumulate and wear you out over the life course in biologically measurable ways. The further challenge to examine the connections between proximal and structural determinants of health, rethinking research designs in order to focus on root causes rather than risk factors. The challenges go on, and these are more or less verbatim from the from our report. Describe the institutions and processes that influence the allocation of resources related to health and its social determinants. There's a partial answer to the question of what political scientists can do, including a focus on how the global context affects policy choices and policy options for improving health. I've highlighted that because it's obviously central to the discussions we're having here. Just as an illustration, to show that this actually can be done, this is a schematic that colleagues and I use to study the connections between globalization and health by way of pathways that lead through the social determinants. I would love to explicate it, but that would take another talk. It's been published in a couple of places. I do want to highlight that the researchers from whose work this was adapted, Finn Didrikson and his colleagues, themselves emphasized the need when studying stratification to focus on those central engines in society that generate and distribute power, wealth, and risks. I'll come back to that notion of risk. Yet another challenge, paying special attention to issues of evidence. There are interventions that cannot be studied using randomized controlled trials. And if you insist on RCTs, you simply preclude a whole range of promising interventions. Finally, involve affected populations, which is often essential to appropriate research designs and their execution. And one of our team members was especially eloquent on that point. Now, against that background, we identified four priority areas for research, which are distinct but closely related, the first of them having to do with global factors and processes that affect health disparities, and that's what much of my work addresses. The second involves influences that affect people's chances to lead healthy lives within a society. For example, we know that rates of overweight and obesity are increasing rapidly, not only in the high-income countries, but also elsewhere. The idea that this is a condition of affluence is no longer viable. You see, for example, that the rates in Mexico a decade ago were comparable to those in the United States. Well, what explains this? For many of us, the lifestyle or behavioral implications or explanations are simply inadequate, and I'll come back to that as well. Third priority area, health system factors, obviously. And finally, and this addresses something that the previous speaker mentioned at the end of his talk, moving from problem space to solution space. What kinds of interventions can work? One of our team members posed the question this way: 20 years from now, how will we know which interventions and policies have worked? It's a good question. Okay. That's the first part. The second part involves implications for global health education, and some of this is going to involve describing things that appear already to be happening at University of Washington, although I didn't know that. Much of the work I do as a social scientist working in population health involves building bridges. Bridges from the institution where I work to a variety of researchers working in areas that are relevant to those upstream factors. So the first priority, I would say, is simply to connect global health education with scholars whose disciplines contribute to understanding the root causes. And immodestly, I would include my own discipline of political science, but also a very long list of other disciplines. This means not only collaborating with people from those disciplines in teaching and research, but also reaching out quite consciously to explain what the health implications are of phenomena like patterns of urban segregation by income or the origins and consequences of financial crisis. I'm always fascinated by the reaction I get when I point out to people in political economy that the financial crisis really does have important health implications, because sometimes they've thought of that, sometimes they hadn't. The second priority is to expand the range of competencies that we regard as essential in terms of understanding a whole range of phenomena in ways that go beyond the simply descriptive and responding to them. I'll give you just three examples. These are opportunistically chosen, and someone from another discipline would probably select quite different examples. The first one involves structural adjustment programs, those reorganizations of economies demanded by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund starting in the 1980s in order to enable debtor countries to reschedule their debts and keep up their payments. Canadian researcher Don DeSavigny and his colleagues, writing in the Tanzanian context, have said that the era of structural adjustment may be over, but the effects of earlier damage continue to cast a long shadow. Well, the era isn't over. The names have just been changed, but that's another story. It's important to know that and to understand the dynamics of structural adjustment as part of a larger process in which a particular political agenda was promoted quite aggressively by some of the richest and most powerful governments in the world. It's important to know that. Second example, coming back to one I mentioned earlier, overweight and obesity. Well, what do overweight and obesity have to do with global health? Quite a lot when you look at trade and investment liberalization and the activities of transnational food corporations. Corinna Hawkes, who's probably the world's leading researcher on this topic, put together this very interesting data set showing the number of meals bought at chain burger and chicken outlets in a number of countries. Most of those outlets, although not all, are transnational. Over a period of just 4 years in the late 1990s, and you can see the dramatic increases in countries as diverse as Russia, Venezuela, and the Philippines. So if we want to understand the origins of that rapid increase in overweight and obesity, we really need to look at the global economic environment. Third example, neoliberalism and what political scientist Jacob Hacker has called the privatization of risk. This is a central element of neoliberal orthodoxy, the shift in responsibility from collective provision to individual provision. The U.S. response to Hurricane Katrina exemplifies the privatization of risk. People who couldn't afford a car to drive to safety, overwhelmingly African American, were left behind essentially to fend for themselves as refugees in their own country. That's the privatization of risk, and there are multiple other examples, not only in disaster management, but also in economic and social policy in countries rich and poor alike. It's important to know that and to understand the dynamics of that process if, for example, you want to make the push toward universal coverage actually happen. third, expand the reach and audience of global health education. And again, it sounds as though much of this is already happening at University of Washington. When Finland held the rotating presidency of the European Union a few years ago, it focused on the theme of health in all policies, reflecting the insight that a lot of the choices that affect health by way of the social determinants are outside the remit of health ministries, and in fact, health ministries may be rather peripheral to making them. The people in the ministries making those choices are likely to have no acquaintance with global health issues, so it would be a good idea, if we want to take this agenda forward, to start offering global health courses of various kinds to people who are not health professionals, who may be studying in social sciences, in development studies, in faculties of law and management, because these are the people who are going to be the functionaries providing policy advice in the future. Now, I don't pretend for a moment that the problem is primarily one of inadequate information. I'd argue it's primarily a function of structural power relations, but adequate information can't hurt. Well, we've been reminded at a number of points in this conference that the social determinants of health are not new and that there is a long history of Latin American leadership, for instance, through the social medicine movement, in addressing social determinants of health. I would say, certainly speaking from the perspective of Canada, that as we move forward on the alliances and partnerships that are the theme of this conference, we certainly have more to learn from you than you from us. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to your questions and comments over the next little while and throughout the rest of the conference.
Hey there, Ted. Ted, that was a wonderfully provocative. Stay here. Don't run away from your questions while the other panel members come forward. Don't run away from the questions. I'm sure you've engendered some. We'll start one, two. Make them short so we can move on to the general discussion.
This is to the panel, but I think you would be the heart of the question. I belong to a consortium of Asia Pacific universities. And just like you mentioned, South America was the leadership for social medicine. Therefore, the values and the structure of the curriculum in the general health field and the public health field was strongly aligned to a global health perspective, structural change and things like that. That was the kind of question I raised with the earlier dean from Tulane. When we are trying to train people for global health, one thing that you made is very clear, that you need to have a kind of core area of studies across disciplines at undergraduate and perhaps in graduate education, which calls for a structural change in academic education in universities, and not a kind of tinkering change that curriculum in schools of public health will do. That's the kind of comment I'm addressing to all of the people.
Mm-hmm. Interesting comment. The question over here.
Hi, I'm Gail Amiel. I'm a veterinarian in Southern California, and I'm also pursuing a master's in public health with the University of Minnesota. I'm really interested and passionate about the role of veterinarians in the promotion of public health worldwide and in developing countries, specifically regarding zoonotic diseases, considering that half of infectious diseases that people get are actually zoonotic diseases that animals can also get. I was wondering, a lot of you guys talked about cooperation with Faculty of Medicine. I was wondering if any of you had cooperation with veterinarians, and what were your thoughts on that?
Pierre?
Yes, I think that's a very important point. ASPH is attending joint meetings with associations of veterinary schools in the U.S., and has been extremely successful. And so you're right, all the impact of zoonosis will keep increasing. It's very important. And there is also, in my own field, there is a very strong tradition of epidemiology in schools of veterinary medicine. So we often hire at schools of public health, faculty who have been trained in School of Veterinary Medicine also. It's a very important point.
So let's open this up now. If we have about 10 minutes for questions for the panel, and we'll have short questions. We'll start at...
Roger, quick answer to that last question,
yeah,
too.
I'm sorry.
The field called One World, One Health is the field that links veterinary medicine to human medicine, and for that matter, to water and food and so on. And there are few instances where agricultural and vet schools are collaborating with health schools. Washington State University and University of Washington are examples because Gates gave a grant to start a new school for global animal health at WSU. University of Minnesota and Manitoba, I understand, are collaborating. There are probably others I don't know of. Mm-hmm.
Question here in the... I'm sorry? I thought you was it was a comment, so I didn't go on. But, value of global health education as a core function of training, of undergraduate training in global health.
It's certainly my philosophy personally is that, and someone else made this point, that global health per se is not a discipline; it's a field that seeks to enable other disciplines to work globally, and that one should not come into global health without having something they bring to the table as a discipline, whether that is biology or social sciences or whatever. On the other hand, I think the potential value of training in global health broadly is enormous. It's a global world, and I don't think people in any discipline today, or in few disciplines at least, would be able to function at their full potential without training in global health, and for that matter, other aspects of global affairs, depending on the discipline.
Certainly that undergraduate education would be important for business, for banking, for communications, for law, for many areas. So I think it's the globalization that's changed the world and has brought us together. Are there other comments, or should we move on to a few questions?
Just to mention that, you know, there is really a trend toward having undergrad programs in public health, and they are often in global public health. At Tulane, we have a very large program now, which is a BSPH, and it's in global public health. It still is mostly, a college degree with a lot of general education, but since the first year, it's about global health. So, I mean, there are different approaches and models. And certainly, it attracts a lot of top-notch students and who wants to start right away.
Richard.
Excellent panel. And near the beginning, Roger mentioned something relating to research and basic science, and then King's last word was basic science in your list. And Pierre's title was Is Global Health Public Health? And what I would like to ask the panel is, what is the real role of basic lab bench science training in global health in the local areas where we're global health practitioners, capacity building? Should basic science, lab bench research, be another major important emphasis as the countries we're trying to help develop develop? And should it be done at the local level, or should we be shipping samples to labs at Columbia University and Harvard and MIT?
King, do you want to answer that?
I think there has been, in the early years of global health, a tendency to think of it as focusing on training in epidemiology, health systems, clinical care. But I think that the pendulum is shifting towards more emphasis on training, and I'm talking about training related to people who will be working in low and middle income countries, that training in all areas of research and certainly including basic sciences is becoming really important to the development of that that country. You heard from Paulo Boos, for example, and you know, Brazil is a great example of a country that's really taken off. But there are lots of examples in that, of that. So, you know, I think it's quite important.
Antoine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciated your brilliant talks. I have two comments, one comment and one question. The comment is about the title of this panel. The title is Beyond Traditional Model. One thing which is not traditional is gender uniformity of your panel. And my question is about one of the key issues, social determinant of health, isn't it women empowerment? And I'm asking you, none of you address this key issue, and I'm asking if what you think about that.
You know, Antoine, I completely agree, and I have a slide that I present when I talk about global health leadership. Because when we look at global health leadership, in, at least in the United States in the 20th century, I have a picture of about 20 old men, all of whom you know, very famous, and there's some on this panel who are even in my picture. And I say that there are three things about global health in the 21st century, and from the past century. One is in the past century, they were all in infectious disease, almost to a one, with the exception of someone like Alan Rosenthal. The second was they were all old men. And the third is they all had early childhood experience in a developing country. And I see in our Fogarty Fellows now that over, about half of them are women, both the fellows and scholars. I see in medical schools when I started, there were 11 women in my class of 140, and now the schools are 50-50. So we're going to see a generational change, and I think the gender equity issue is absolutely front and center of where we're going. And I speak that as because my wife is also the only woman chair of a department of pediatrics, of a department in a major medical school. So it, that level of gender equity is just coming in the United States in a big way. So I think we would all agree, and I don't know if anyone wants to give a specific comment.
Well, you missed the fact that we all have dark navy suits, you know, which is, you know, part of the uniform, I guess, also. So you're right on. But I think the things are changing and will be changing very fast. I think down the road, probably the gender balance might be unbalanced the other way around, which might not be a bad thing. So good point.
There's still the basic issue of women's rights and differences in education, extent to which limited education is a factor in the ability of women to gain those rights. So, but the slide I had to skip had two issues around gender issues and women's rights, but sorry I didn't get the time.
So, excellent panel. I just a quick comment around the competencies and the curriculum. There's clearly a huge groundswell of interest in global health, whether it's undergrad or it's at different schools. So I think we're going to become interdisciplinary because the students are demanding it. I mean, I think this is for the grounds up. Well, my concern is that while they're very focused on global health, I still see a focus that looks like international health. They're very interested in helping Africa and Latin America, but they're kind of missing the U.S., and I do all my R01-funded research in a developing country called downtown Atlanta. And I really worry that we need to be sure that we do not let our students and our training in global health totally ignore the tremendous inequities and problems that exist in the U.S.
If Julio Frank were here, he would say that global health and domestic health are one and the same, and that part of what we're learning in global health is how to deal with problems at home and vice versa. So I think that's a very cogent comment. I see a couple hands way in the back of students who might want to respond to this.
I actually have a question. My name is Sujal Parikh. I'm a third-year medical student at the University of Michigan. I have two questions. I hope that each of the members of the panel can respond. To what extent have students been involved in developing the priorities and the programs that all of you have talked about? not just in vetting end products? And more, my second question, which I think is more important, what do you envision the role of students being as we move forward?
Role of students moving forward. Pierre?
Well, I think it's, of course, very, very important in our process to build competencies within the Association of Schools of Public Health. Students are involved. They are involved in the groups for each domain, and they will be also involved more broadly in the Delphi process. So I think it's absolutely central. You cannot build this without students. And just also to comment very briefly about the previous question, which was about not forgetting domestic issues. I mean, that's exactly the point. It's really about linking the two. And something which really helped us to do this at Tulane was Katrina. So I'm glad that Ted showed a slide. But with Katrina, we had, which is a hurricane which hit New Orleans 5 years ago, we had an incredible influx of students who wanted to come to Tulane because they wanted to do something in the community in New Orleans, but they also wanted to work somewhere else in the world. So it's feasible to link the two.
Ted, did you want to come?
Actually, two quick comments in answer to that question. In Canada, students are very much the leaders in terms of driving the interest at the university level in expanding global health programs. On that previous question, I couldn't agree more. One of the most important reasons for studying globalization in the context of the social determinants of health is that in the worldwide marketplace, the gap between rich and poor now runs within nations as much as it does between them. The income gap, the household income gap between the richest and poorest census tracts in the Greater Toronto Area, which is our country's largest metropolitan area, is considerably larger than the gap in GDP per capita between the United States and Mexico.
Now, the study that was published initially in JAMA by Chris Murray, I think the title was The Nine Americas.
Eight Americas,
good. Well, maybe you should describe the study too. But it basically looked at differences in life expectancy across the eight Americas. And I think the overall difference in life expectancy between the best and the worst was about 20 years of life expectancy. And the, even after adjusting for poverty and race, things like access to health care remain quite important.
Sí, en el tema de estudiantes quisiera añadir que hace un año la Unión Internacional de Promoción de la Salud,
the International Unit for Health Promotion and Health Education, implemented a network of students for global health and for health promotion, and the seat of that International Students Network is located at the Norway University. It is a project headed by Maurice Mittelman, so it is an additional possibility. It is a communications global mechanism to address global health and health promotion. Tenemos tiempo para
the last word, so I'll have the last question up there.
The question of structural adjustment, and that we are not through that era. Could you tell us how you see that at present impacting global health?
Well, the most immediate impact, at least until very, very recently, the IMF claims this is no longer the case, was by way of the public expenditure ceilings that countries were asked, and I say asked advisedly, to incorporate into their macroeconomic policies in order to get sign-off on their poverty reduction strategy papers, and more generally, to get the IMF seal of approval that drastically increases the ease with which a low- and middle-income country can borrow in international markets. Back in 2005, Horik Ohms, who was then with Médecins Sans Frontières, and I published a paper in The Lancet that talked about these expenditure ceilings based on his experience in Mozambique. And the IMF and the World Bank provided indignant replies saying, oh, no, it's not like that at all. And then to its credit, the IMF commissioned a report from its own internal evaluation office, which a couple of years later said, no, it's not like that at all. In fact, it's considerably worse. So I don't know the current state of play with respect to those. My fear in the aftermath of the financial crisis, which of course originated with a particular form of predatory capitalism in the United States, is that the uncertainties associated with the financial crisis will be used as the pretext for demanding another tranche of austerity measures, not only in low and middle income countries, but also in countries like Canada and the U.S.
Last question, Neil Nathanson.
So I'd like to ask the panel to reflect a bit on the, in global health education, on the balance or the proper balance between specialists and generalists. Because my sense is that when it comes to interventions, and this has been mentioned sort of along the way, what you need is a team of specialists who can really bring some different kinds, but some expertise, not just a set of generalists. And I wonder if the panel can comment on that, because there's been a lot of emphasis on sort of generalist approach to education, but when you're actually going to solve problems, you often need people with real expertise in a variety of different disciplines, and maybe they can comment about that balance.
Uh-huh. Good question. Who wants to comment on that one? Pierre? King? You look quiet, King.
Well, I said earlier that I think you need to bring a discipline into the field to be able to really add to the field. A counter-argument was made that lots of people are interested. You made it, Pierre, that these global health, global public health undergraduate programs that teach public health, nutrition, aspects of global health are also popular. So there are different views on that.
That's about undergrad education. I think that at the level of the graduate education, I agree that people need to be specialized. I just don't believe they have to be specialized in international health. I think they have to be specialized in a discipline, and they have to have a global approach to that discipline so they can apply epidemiology in New Orleans after Katrina, in Mexico, in Burkina Faso, and in Belgium.
Great. Well, listen, this has been, to me, a very exciting and interesting session. We've covered a lot of material. I really want to thank the Institute of Public Health here for hosting this and allowing us to organize this and bring you all together. I have to thank the speakers, and won't you thank the speakers with me for this wonderful presentation. Thank you.